Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is entitled Burning Down the House with special guest John Lentini. So now, here's your host, everybody, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome, everyone. Today we're honored to be joined by John Lentini, who's the author of Scientific Protocols for Fire Investigation. John Lentini is one of the leading fire investigators in the United States. He's the president and chief investigator of Scientific Fire Analysis, LLC. He's authored over 3,000 technical reports and testified in over 200 cases since 1975. And that's testimony for both plaintiffs and defendants, and is a neutral court-hired expert. He's appeared on Frontline, 2020, and other television programs. And I have to say, John has worked tirelessly, and I don't know how you continue to find the energy, John, but tirelessly for through his professional associations and through individual efforts to improve how we investigate fires and at the forensic analysis of fire science and scientific integrity in fire investigations. So welcome, John. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
Yeah, John, welcome to the show. Let's kind of start by giving people an understanding of what the scientific investigation of fire is really all about. When you approach a suspicious fire, what, in general, types of things are you hoping to uncover when you approach this?
Well, the first thing you have to do is figure out where the fire started. If it's a suspicious fire, or if it's really an arson fire, it's usually not very hard to figure that out. Arsonists are not all that clever, and they do things like pour 10 gallons of gasoline, and so there's usually plenty of evidence left behind when somebody sets a fire intentionally. The hard ones are the accidents, figuring out what caused them. But you need to keep an open mind for as long as possible. And this is one of the problems that I have seen now in fire investigation. I started out working for the police, and then I was usually only called out when it was a pretty obvious arson, and I would collect the samples. And then I started working for insurance companies, and the universe of fires that was presented to me was suspicious fires. And I found about 40% of them turned out to be real arson fires, and I could prove it. And then another 40%, I could figure out what accidental cause there was. I think, yeah, see, it's this toaster or this water heater or this furnace. And about 20% of the time, I just ended up throwing up my hands and saying, I don't know. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people in this business. I'd like to say it's a profession, but it's evolving, who are afraid to say they don't know because their boss will be mad at them, their clients will be mad at them. I mean, just imagine an insurance company adjuster pay somebody $2,000 to go investigate a fire, and they come back and they say, well, I don't know. That'll be $2,000, please. And, you know, you don't want to do that too often, or people won't call you. On the other hand, if you can't figure it out, you can't figure it out. And a lot of times, you can't figure it out.
Right. Well, obviously there are going to be consequences for somebody on the end of this beyond just the insurance company.
Huge consequences. If you are accused by a prosecutor of committing a crime, you are going to be broke at the end unless you're filthy rich to start with, even if you're acquitted. And I've seen this happen time after time, and people say, well, where do I go to get all the money back that I just spent keeping my butt out of the penitentiary? And the answer is nowhere. The prosecutors are so powerful that once they decide to accuse you, you are in deep doo-doo.
Well, sir, can you take us through the basic steps of a fire investigation, how a scene is processed, and what a fire investigator's work at the scene is like, and then later in the lab?
Sure. Well, the lab is easy. The scene is pretty complicated. You go around, you look at the outside, you look at the inside, you generally go from the area of least damage to greatest damage. And that's because you want to look at everything. It's not because when you get to the area of greatest damage, you're necessarily at the point of origin. The area with the greatest damage is the area that had the best combination of fuel and ventilation. And this is something that we are just now beginning to figure out, is that the ventilation is what controls the amount of damage. So if you have a place that gets ventilated late in the event, but it gets plenty of air and there's plenty of fuel, that's where the greatest amount of damage is. So what you have to do is look at all of the fire patterns and see which ones you cannot explain in terms of ventilation. And those are the places you want to look. So a lot of times when a fire starts in a room and the room goes to flashover, which is a very interesting phenomenon where you go from a fire in a room to a room on fire, that transition sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And so the only place the fire is going to burn after that is where there's an opening, where the ventilation, like a window or a door, or perhaps across the room from the vent, across from the door or across from the window. And it can be very, very confusing if you don't understand the ventilation.
Well, so that, I mean, I think for a lot of us who don't do this for a living, the idea that you can just walk in among what looks to us like a lot of charcoal and anything. So are, I mean, how, I know that you're, you know, ultimately able to make something out of what to the rest of us is just sort of ash and ruin, and discover what was there feeding it, essentially, what its fuel sources were then also, or what are some, sort of things that you're looking for there beyond the ventilation?
One of the things that you have to look for is where the fire started. And if you find where you think the fire started, usually you will find your cause there. But if you go there and you say, all right, the fire started in this part of the room, and I look around and I see nothing, well, somebody must have lit it. And this is where we get into trouble, is people making determinations based on an absence of evidence. But they can do it. And the one thing that fire investigators learn to do is testify. And they testify very confidently. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of correlation between confidence and correctness. In fact,
that's true in many things in life.
Yeah,
well, let me ask you, so it's bad enough that somebody burns down a business or burns down a building or a home or something like that. But what about when there's a loss of life? If a corpse is found by the fire people that are putting the fire out, and of course you're called in, the police are called in, the coroner is called in, what do you, as a arson investigator, what do you have to do with the body, if anything? I mean, I know it really belongs to the coroner, but what clues do you get, or does any evidence that you obtain from the corpse itself that helps you determine at that point in time what transpired here?
No, the corpse is the most important piece of evidence. Human bodies make great collectors of evidence because hemoglobin is has an attraction for carbon monoxide more than 200 times more powerful than its attraction for oxygen. So you can tell, you know, unless the body is totally cremated, which doesn't happen very often, you can tell if the person was alive or dead at the time of the fire based on their carbon monoxide level. If it's zero, you got a problem. That means the person was dead to start with before the fire happened. And that's a very big clue. Now, they have a bullet hole in their head, another big clue.
Right.
but that's
never,
the body.
Never forget to look for the obvious, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But the body is the single most important piece of evidence. It also tends to make people get emotional and start looking for, you know, someone to blame, particularly if there's children that die. And, you know, some of the more major miscarriages that have taken place have been the result of somebody wanting to find someone to pay for these dead children. You know, sometimes children die in fires. You know, we have several thousand people die every year in fires. But that's when things tend to go off the rails, is when people get very emotional about the deaths. Generally, a prosecutor doesn't care about somebody ripping off their insurance company. The insurance company cares, but the prosecutors are not going to get all excited about it, because fires they're very hard to prosecute. But if you got a dead kid, somebody's going to pay. So, but the body is critical in figuring out what went on with the fire.
Well, let me follow up on something you said there, because it might be counterintuitive to our listeners, though. What you said is absolutely true. You said that bodies are rarely totally cremated. So a house burns down around, there's a body in the rubble. Why is it not just always reduced to ash? What are the things that make that not?
Water doesn't burn very well, and we are 90% water. So
yep.
People that kill somebody and then they say, well, let's have a fire and cover this up, rarely succeed at that.
Right.
The places where you'll see it work the best is in vehicles. When there's a body inside a vehicle, if you can get that vehicle to burn all the way down, the body is going to be pretty badly damaged. But it's not going to go away. There's still going to be bones.
Right.
And people don't know there's a body there.
There's a lot of things that burn very hot inside an automobile, not just the gasoline.
Well, that's sort of a misconception. The temperature at which substances burn doesn't really depend on what the substance is. It depends on how much ventilation it gets, how much oxygen it gets.
Sure.
Fire investigators have had this misconception for many, many years, though, that people use gasoline to make a fire burn hotter. Well, if you think about what a blacksmith does when he wants his fire to be hotter, what does he do? He doesn't change the fuel.
Right.
He blows on it. So it's the temperature is all about the amount of ventilation that you have. And a crematorium, they have lots of ventilation. You know, they have forced air going in there. You don't generally get that in a fire. You have diffusion flames.
So what are some of the ways that in scientific fire investigation you can tell if a fire has been deliberately set?
Well, most people that deliberately set fires use gasoline. And the gasoline doesn't all go away. And so you can find it if you know where to look for it. You can use a dog to help you find it. Dogs are very good at that. You can use your own nose. The only problem with that is you've got to put your nose down on the floor. I've been seen doing that. But a dog is, you know, they're happy to sniff out the whole place. So you take the samples, you bring them back to the laboratory, and we have very, very sensitive techniques for detecting petroleum products. I can, without working up a sweat, find a tenth of a microliter of gasoline in a gallon of fire debris. That's like 1/500th of a drop. It's pretty small.
Yeah.
Now, when I first got into business, we used to boil it. We used to boil the debris and look for a visible layer of oily liquid that would float on top of the distillate. and it was really not sensitive. And so laboratories put out lots and lots of false negative reports. It wasn't, they weren't false. They just didn't detect anything. And we always said, failure to find something doesn't mean it wasn't there. And that is true today. We still say that just because we didn't find it doesn't mean it wasn't there at the fire scene. It just means we didn't find it. And so we have an argument with some dog people, dog handlers, to say, my dog is more sensitive than the laboratory, and if my dog alerts, that means there's something there. And there's a big controversy going on in Phoenix right now with a number of people that are suing the fire department because they were accused of arson falsely based on dog alerts. So the dog can help you select samples that have a higher likelihood of coming up positive in the lab. But if the lab doesn't find it, the dog is really not relevant, but some people think it is.
Well, I think that's something that, you know, and again, there's a huge spectrum of who's out there handling dogs, but, you know, they've seen that in a lot of areas with working dogs is the handler influencing the dog in some way? Even the handler may not realize.
Well, right. A lot of times it's totally subconscious. And you know, I'm not wouldn't suggest that somebody's being evil, although there have been some evil guys. Dog handlers that really are evil guys that actually belong in the penitentiary themselves. But it's just, you know, you get this bias going on. And people think that the dog knows better, and they give the dog clues because they'll see a pattern on the floor that they think is caused by a flammable liquid, and they want the dog to alert.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's lots of good dog handlers out there that know better. The thing about accelerant detection canines, though, is they're somehow special. If you've got a drug dog and he alerts on a suitcase and the police open up the suitcase and they don't find any drugs, nobody goes to jail. You got a bomb dog, same thing. They don't find any bombs. They don't find any explosives. Nobody's even arrested. But with accelerant dogs, people say, oh, my dog knows better. And they make arrests based on dogs. Mm. It's just crazy. Just crazy.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned, along that line, you mentioned accelerants and obviously gasoline, kerosene, stuff like that's pretty common and easy to come by. But people also use timing devices of various types so they can be, you know, in the next county when the fire starts. So what are the most common accelerants and timing devices, and what are some of the most interesting and clever ones you've come across?
Well, the most common one is to take a book of matches.
Right.
And you light a cigarette and tuck it into the book of matches, and you've got 5 or 10 minutes before the matches ignite, and that makes a very good timing device, and it tends to not survive, and so people don't find them a lot. There was a guy in California, though, John Orr. He found them all the time, but he knew where they were because he put them there.
Right.
Everybody thought he was such a great investigator, and it turns out he was an arsonist.
I remember that case. He was.
He's on death row.
That's a famous case.
Yeah.
Yeah, they followed his travels up and down California.
Well, it used to be that he would light fires on his way to speaking engagements.
Yeah, to conventions. Yeah,
yeah. And that's how they caught him. You know, they just noticed this coincidence.
Every time
John Orr drove through a town on his way to a speaking engagement, that they'd have a fire. And a lot of times he'd get called to investigate it and. Wow, he's amazing. He can find the origin of this fire that nobody else can figure out. Well, it's easy if you know where you started it.
Right.
Inside trading.
You know. And other timing devices, you know, you can get a Kmart timer, you know, and plug it in and attach it to a hot plate. The only trouble with that is after the fire's over, there's a hot plate with a cord plugged into a Kmart timer. It might be burned, but it's still a clue.
Right.
And, you know, I have seen that. You can use candles. They're a little problematic because you've got to practice and figure out how long the candle burns because some of them Some candles will burn in 2 hours, and some will burn in 2 days.
And it's
also
hard to
dangerous.
Predict that, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen, you know, lots and lots of accelerants. There was one story that I've heard of. I don't know if this is true, but you take a balloon and you fill it with gasoline and you suspend it above a candle and you swing. You let it swing like a pendulum. And when it finally comes to rest, it does, as it goes through the flame, it doesn't ignite because it's going so fast. But once it finally comes to rest, then the candle will burn a hole through the balloon and light it. And that's not likely to leave a lot of evidence behind. But there's generally people just splash and dash. I mean,
yeah.
I haven't really seen a lot of timing devices. I've seen a few. But it's generally not that sophisticated a crime.
Well, I know everything in forensic science has changed dramatically over the last, you know, half century. And as far as the scientific investigation of fire, when did all this really start, when we really started looking at it? I mean, you know, we've had a fascination with fire ever since Prometheus defied the gods and gave it to man, and we probably used it to do harm to others for about that long, too. The others are their property. But when did this profession really become scientific? When we really started looking at the chemistry and physics behind stuff.
Very recently. There have been fire protection engineers, people who design sprinkler systems and fire alarms and buildings. And then there were fire investigators. And they were two different people, two different classes of people. The engineers were college-educated, and they knew about chemistry and physics. And the fire investigators were firemen. And back in the day, it wasn't considered glamorous duty at all. Sometimes you would get sent to the investigation unit when you were injured and could no longer do extinguishment. Or sometimes you would do something to make the chief angry with you. And it was almost a punishment detail. But even after they started getting more professional, they didn't have the education to understand their training in fire investigation. People trained them. But they had no basic education beyond high school. They're firemen. I love firemen. Firemen run into buildings and save people's lives. They're heroes. But extinguishing fires and investigating fires require two different skill sets. And one of the skills is the ability to recognize when you don't know. Extinguishment, they always succeed. They never walk away from a fire while the thing's still burning. They always put that fire out. In investigation, sometimes you walk away and you don't know. So in the mid-1980s, somebody brought to the attention of the Standards Council of the National Fire Protection Association concerns about the quality of fire investigation in the United States. And the Standards Council at that point said, you're right. It's pretty grim out there. So they convened a technical committee on fire investigation to write a handbook for how to do the work scientifically. And FPA is all about science. And 7 years later, in 1992, they came out with NFPA 921, Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations. And it's now in its, I think, eighth edition. Every 3 years, it gets updated. And when it first came out in 1992, the fire investigation business went ballistic. They said, who are these people and how dare they tell me how to do my job? And they fought it tooth and nail for the first 8 years. In 2000, we got over 100 proposals to take the word science out of the guide. They said, we don't do science. We do a systematic evaluation. Well, that got shot down 29-0 in the committee. But that will tell you how the fire investigation profession viewed standardization and science. They hated it. And right around 2000, we're talking 14 years ago, the tide began to turn. The International Association of Arson Investigators finally decided to endorse NFPA 921. The U.S. Department of Justice decided to endorse NFPA 921. And the courts finally decided to endorse a scientific approach. And this comes out of the Daubert ruling from 1993, where the Supreme Court said, you guys have got to, you know, be reliable. When you put experts on the stand, you've got to be reliable. And one of the ways you can judge reliability is whether there are standards controlling the technique. And 921 is a standard. And so it was in the late 90s when the court started enforcing that. And again, the fire investigation profession went ballistic. But they have finally realized that it's time that we approach fires in a scientific manner.
People don't like change.
People don't like change.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and we will be back soon to learn more about scientific fire investigation with John Lentini.
And so I want to welcome everybody back here after the break on Crime and Science Radio, again with your host, Doug Lyle and Dan Burke. Again, today's episode is entitled Burning Down the House with very special guest, John Lantini. So now here, everybody, here you go. Back to the show with Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everyone. John, before the break, we were hearing some pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, I think most people, I'm hoping most people would be surprised to hear that really it's fewer than 15 years have passed since things really got on a more scientific footing with arson investigation and fire investigation. So let's go back a little bit before that, because I know you've had a key role to play in a lot of this, and especially, you know, there are some major cases that you have really, I think, probably helped people to take a different look at, and one of those happened in 1990 in Jacksonville, Florida, where a man was accused of setting a fire that killed his pregnant wife, her sister, and her sister's four children. You were talking earlier when children are involved, how emotionally, the emotional impact of that, and the likelihood of a prosecution coming about. So Gerald Wayne Lewis was facing a death penalty case. Tell us about the Gerald Wayne Lewis case and what happened there.
I was first contacted by the prosecutor and asked for a second opinion on the chemistry. There was a chemist with the Florida Fire Marshal's Office that had identified gasoline in a sample of fire debris, and the public defender knew this chemist, and he knew him to be an incompetent hack. And he said to the prosecutor, "You should get a second opinion on the chemistry." Well, I knew the chemist too, and I gave it to my associate. I said, "Look at this, please. I can't be objective about this man's work." I didn't tell her that. I just said, "Look at this work and see if you see any gasoline in it." And she said, "No, there's no gasoline here." And at that point, I copied the chromatograms, and at the time we weren't using mass spectrometry, copied the chromatograms and sent them off to the 10 top people in the country that knew how to do fire debris analysis. And they were unanimous. They said, "What do you mean? There's no gasoline here." And then the prosecutor said to me, "Well, that's kind of really important evidence. We're going to have a hard time with this case." And he said, "Do you know anybody that can do a second opinion on the fire scene?" And I said, "I can do that." And I didn't have any relationship with the previous fire investigator. And I went down and looked at the scene, and they showed me the evidence. And I said, "Well, this looks like a pour pattern going through the living room doorway." And I didn't know any better. And it was just about that time that people were starting to understand that flashover would create burning on the floor that could look like flammable liquids. So said to the prosecutor, "You know, we need to get somebody that knows about this kind of defense." And we got John DeHaan from California. And he came, and he was an employee of the California Attorney General, the Department of Justice. And they rented him out to Florida. And he came and saw that there was a house, exactly the same house, two doors down. And the city owned it. It had been taken over because people hadn't paid their taxes. And we said, "Let's burn this house down." And so we refurbished the house with, you know, put in new sheetrock, new carpet. We got furniture exactly the same as was in the house where the people died. And we lit a test fire. And we were thinking, oh, 15 or 20 minutes, this thing will flash over. It flashed over in 4 minutes. And it behaved exactly the way the defendant had said it did. And I was running a video camera at the time, and a city fire marshal walk by the camera, and he says, "Wow, that may prove the defendant's case." And it did. It absolutely did. And fortunately, the two prosecutors from Jacksonville were the most ethical prosecutors I've ever met. And they said, "You know what? We really don't want to send an innocent man to the electric chair." And they dropped the charges. And they caught all kinds of grief. The fire investigation people in Florida, when they saw the result of our investigation, they called me everything but a child of God. I went and I was on a stage, sharing a stage with one of the prosecutors, and we were explaining how this thing went. And people were mad at us. They said, "Oh, you should have let it go to trial." Given that fire investigators are very largely controlled by the law enforcement organization, so they're cops. And this is one of the problems we have is you got your police hat and your scientist hat, and some people don't know when to take one hat off and put the other hat on, and there's a lot of confusion, and that's just the way we've set it up in this country. We have people that are supposed to do scientific investigations, they're also cops, and so they can get biasing information. They might know that the house is for sale. They might know that the guy was mad with his wife. But we had a lot of information in the Lime Street case, which is the one you're talking about, that verified what the defendant told us. He told us there was a jug containing about a quart of gasoline. It was a gallon jug, had about a quart of gasoline. It was in his car. He was sleeping in his car. But he said he had mowed the lawn that day, and sure enough, we could go out and we could see that he had, in fact, mowed the lawn. He said that he got a garden hose, and we found the remains of the garden hose on the front porch. He said that he had used water from the kitchen sink to fill up a pan to throw on the fire, and we found the kitchen sink was still running. I mean, the valve was still open. So there were a lot of things that he told us about his activities that matched with reality, but still we had dead children. And in the end, we decided that we couldn't rule out the possibility that his four-year-old son had set the fire playing with a Bic lighter. And that caused me to reevaluate the way I looked at fires, because I had almost, I mean, I had looked at the patterns and said, this looks like an arson. But it wasn't, or certainly wasn't. We weren't able to prove it.
Well, you know, I think at the beginning of that story, you said a couple of things that I'm not sure most people are aware of how unusual they are. First was that a public defender said, "Get another expert," and the prosecutor actually did it. I mean, and I think there are, for one thing, there are costs involved in doing that, and in some jurisdictions, you're going to have a prosecutor's office that's going to say, I've got an expert. He's testified in X number of cases. He's good enough. You know, I've done what I need to do." So you actually had somebody who
they wanted to get it right. And prosecutors are supposed to want to get it right. It doesn't matter what it costs. They've got unlimited resources. And particularly if you're a defendant and you look at what kind of resources the state or the United States can bring to bear against you, it's scary. But they've got unlimited resources, basically. And they've got unlimited discretion. They are the most powerful people in our society. And these guys understood that, and they also understood that they wanted to do the right thing. And, it is unusual. I've seen prosecutors that just don't care. When a grand jury indicts somebody, their job is to get the conviction, and they just don't care. And, you know, those people are my natural prey.
On the Transvaal, as it were.
So you are known in the community of forensic scientists for working hard to debunk myths that have long persisted in fire investigation, including some that have led to wrongful convictions. And can you give us just some examples of the ways that we've gone wrong?
Well, we had, back in 1977, there was a survey of fire investigators by the Aerospace Corporation working on a Justice Department contract. And they asked people, how do you determine arson? And these guys all responded to the survey, and they listed the different things that they used. One of them was crazed glass. That's very tiny cracks in glass that they said was caused by rapid heating. Not true. Another one is the alligatoring, big shiny alligator blisters. Char blisters are what happens when you burn wood, and it takes on the appearance of an alligator's skin. And for some reason, people thought that big shiny blisters meant rapid heating, and that must have been from an accelerant. And this was written down in books. So at the end of 1977, the Aerospace Corporation scientists who were doing this survey said, you know, we really ought to run some experiments so that we can put out a handbook. And 3 years later, the National Bureau of Standards, the most respected science and engineering body on the planet, put out a handbook. Unfortunately, they hadn't done any experiments. They went to the National Fire Academy, and they got the myths. And so they told people about crazed glass being an indicator of accelerant, about shiny alligator blisters, about spalled concrete, about more burning on the floor than on the ceiling, all kinds of false indicators of rapid heating or high temperatures. Well, it turns out, as I said earlier, temperature is the same. Wood and gasoline burn at the same temperature. It all depends. The temperature is completely and totally and only dependent on ventilation. So that big myth underlied a lot of these little myths. I went out to Oakland. They had a huge fire there in 1991, burned down 3,000 homes, killed a bunch of folks, and most people were saying, oh, what a horrible tragedy. But forensic scientists are like buzzards. I said, what an opportunity to do research on the baseline, what a house should look like when it's burned in an accident. And we knew that none of those houses were intentionally set on fire. They were all just caught up in this firestorm. And so we went around and looked for evidence of arson in these burned homes, and we found it. We found crazed glass. We found evidence of high temperatures. We found melted copper. We found melted steel. We found spalled concrete. And I wrote it up in Fire Technology, peer-reviewed journal on fires. Not not a lot of fire investigators actually read. So we did a slightly less technical version and put it in a trade magazine called The Fire and Arson Investigator. And people, at that point they started thinking what a terrible person I was for taking away their tools.
Well, but again, if it's going to be scientific, then there has to be repeatability. I mean, that's one of the things.
Well, one of the easiest things to, and a lot of them said, oh, you guys in your lab coats, you're running tests in the laboratory. A fire scene is not a laboratory. But one of the easiest things to test was the crazed glass myth. And I had worked on a case in a post-conviction matter in Arizona called Arizona versus Girdler, where they found crazed glass, and they said they used that as part of the evidence to convict him. And the easy thing to do is just to heat the glass up. You can heat it up slowly. You can heat it up rapidly. You can do it any way you want. And I never got the glass to craze, no matter how quickly I heated it. I put it on a propane burner and just lit the burner. And you don't get any more rapid heating than that. And the glass would break, but it wouldn't craze. But I found out that I could get the glass to craze reproducibly every time just by spraying water on it. So it's rapid cooling, not rapid heating, that causes crazing. And yet, we've got this book published by the National Bureau of Standards. It says crazed glass means rapid heating. And, you know, who is, you know, any fire investigator, who are they to question the National Bureau of By God Standards? You know, and so there was a lot of this mythology that was codified by this very respected organization. It's almost like the Pope. You know, when he says it, you know, Catholics believe it. When the National Bureau of Standards says something, it's now called the National Institute of Standards and Technology. But back then, when the National Bureau of Standards said something, nobody bothered to check. You believed it. Only I bothered to check.
Well, then, this brings up a mea culpa. Since in the chapters on arson investigation in two of my books, Forensics for Dummies and How Done It Forensics, both perpetrate these myths then, because I use the sources that you've cited when I was writing about it. So all you listeners out there who have those books, please disregard the chapters on arson.
Who could blame you for citing the National Bureau of Standards? And the thing is...
Exactly. I had that report. That was part of one of the things I researched in writing that chapter.
Absolutely. And all kinds of book authors cited that book.
Yes.
And so the whole literature of fire investigation, right up until the mid-90s, was polluted with these myths. And there's a lot of people don't buy all the books. You know, they only buy one or two of them.
Right.
And a lot of people, they learn these myths at the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland. They go there, and this is what I do when I look at somebody's resume. If they haven't been back since 2000, I worry about their abilities to correctly call a fire, because I know that they're going to be using these myths.
Well, speaking of myths, and besides my two books, what other inaccuracies do you see in books and movies, we're talking now more fictional portrayals, I guess, that drive you nuts, that you say, whoa, wait a minute, stop. Didn't anybody ask these questions?
Oh, well, I like NCIS, but the instrument that Abby uses isn't what she says it is. I don't watch a lot. I don't watch CSI at all. I watched it one time where they were able to pour wax into a wound and pull out a knife, the shape of a knife, you know. And at that point, I just said, I'm not going to watch this anymore.
Right.
because it's entertaining.
Yeah.
The same is true of Backdraft. That film was shot with the cameras upside down so that they could get the fire to go along the roof, along the ceiling of the rooms. It was totally bogus. Great movie, but totally bogus when it comes to fire investigation. There's lots and lots of movies where you'll see a puddle of gasoline. Somebody flips a cigarette into it, and it lights the gasoline on fire. You can't do it. Don't try it at home. But ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, recently did something on the order of 4,500 tests trying to light gasoline puddles, gasoline-soaked clothing, with a cigarette, and they could not do it. They got zero ignitions. So when you see that in a movie, I've actually seen the movie slowed down and the fire approaches the cigarette. It doesn't start with the cigarette. So
Well, this is also stuff, though, that, I mean, I think you've raised an important point when you're talking about CSI. I mean, I think people need to realize that they are not running the Academy of Forensic Science on television for people it's not an educational channel that these are on, and they are dramas, and people are going to, you know, as with the wound and the, you know, the rubber in the wound or whatever, the wax in the wound, this is, you know, they're not trying to, I think, you know, however they may try to, you know, use generally forensic science technology for their stories. Ultimately, they're writing a story.
Right.
But this stuff gets in our heads.
It does. We call it the CSI effect.
Yeah.
And jurors expect some kind of fancy scientific instrument, or they want to see some DNA. They expect this kind of stuff, and it's just not real. And I don't know any forensic scientists that wear Prada.
Well, I always quote one of our dear friends, Lee Goldberg, and Lee is a prolific novelist and screenwriter and a funny, funny guy, but he's famously said many, many times, and I think this is a lesson for all of us. He says, given the choice between scientific fact and story, I'll take story every time.
Sure, that's what people want to read. That's what they want to watch, but it's not real.
They're storytellers, exactly,
yeah.
And that's good. That's okay, as long as you know that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
I'm thinking of, the changes that you're talking about, that and knowing that when we're talking about nationally impacting how something has been done, that there have got to be possibly, we'll say at this point, some people, not out of even ill will, but just out of a lack of knowledge, have ended up convicted of arson. So to prevent that from continuing, what are some of the things that we can do to improve the way fires are investigated in the United States? And what should, as members of the public, what should we be looking at locally and in our various jurisdictions to demand better standards? What do we need to be doing?
Are you willing to pay higher taxes? If you want to pay a fire investigator $40,000 a year, you're not going to get a college graduate. You're not going to get somebody that is smart enough or educated enough to do the job right. So, number one, you've got to hire better people. Number two, and most importantly, I think, is we need to put in a dividing line, a bifurcation, both in investigations and in trials. In the investigation, you can have two partners that switch off these roles, but one of them is the main guy, the principal investigator, and he knows everything. And the other one is the guy that's going to just do the physical evidence. And he should know pretty much nothing. He should know what the eyewitnesses saw at the time of the fire. And not much else. And let him go and let the evidence talk to him without being biased by knowing that the guy got in a fight with his wife, or that the house was for sale, or that they were 3 months behind on the mortgage. All of this stuff has nothing to do with the cause of the fire. And if we had different people determining the cause versus determining who done it, we have one guy tries to figure out what happened, and the other guy tries to figure out who done it. And you can switch those roles off, and that will lead to way more objectivity and will minimize the expectation bias. The second place is in the courts. Arson is about the only kind of crime where it's not always clear that a crime has been committed. You know, you got a bank robbery, you got a rape, you got a murder. You know, it's pretty clear. Somebody did bad. But with a fire, you can't tell. And so the prosecution should be held to a standard where they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this was in fact an arson fire. And then, and only then, do they get to do the character assassination. And the opposite happens. And in cases where the science is really weak, you don't even see the science until day six or day seven of the trial. First, they get the jury to hate the defendant. And the jury already thinks the defendant is guilty anyways, or he wouldn't be there. And they're probably mad at him because they got jury duty because of this guy. So they get the jury to hate the defendant, and by the time they put the science on, the jury doesn't care. And it ought to be the other way around. They ought to be required to prove their arson, prove that it really wasn't intentionally set fire. And then and only then do they get to present evidence about what a bad guy the defendant is.
So the average person wakes up one night in their bed and smoke's billowing under the door of their bedroom, and they know that the house is on fire. What are the do's and don'ts for that person right there at that point in time?
Get the hell out of the house. Call 911 if you can, but just get out of the house. If you've got a piece of upholstered furniture on fire, you could have as few as 3 minutes to get out of your house.
Do you open doors, open windows?
No, you don't open windows. Well, the only reason you should open a window is to get out.
To jump out, right.
Just to jump out. Right, get your children out. Don't try to fight it. Just get out of there. And there are people that think they can run through fire to save their children. And
exactly.
This happens in the cases where children die. The parents on the jury say, well, I would have rescued my child. You can't run into a room full of fire and rescue people. It
right.
can't be done.
John, thank you so much. I know you've got a full plate, especially right now, and we really, really appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. Thanks so
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely.
My pleasure. Thank you.